ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the federal government announces a gun buyback scheme in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack. Also, funerals have been held for more of the victims today, including two heroes who tried to stop the gunman. And Formula One motor racing set for a shake-up with a bigger focus on electric power.
This is a huge regulation change for the sport. It's possibly the biggest one in history. They'll have a near 50-50 split between the internal combustion engine and the electrical energy, and they'll run on sustainable fuel.
Two of the amazing heroes of the Bondi attack have been farewelled at a funeral service in Sydney's east today. Boris and Sophia Gurman bravely tried to disarm one of the gunmen before the massacre began and lost their lives as a result. Friends and family have remembered the hard work and determination of the Bondi locals to make a good life for their family after migrating from the Soviet Union, and remembered their courage and selflessness in their final moments. Alison Chow prepared this report.
Under a scorching sun in Sydney's east, mourners follow the hearses carrying the bodies of Boris and Sophia Gurman. This was a couple that tried to fight off one of the attackers in Sunday's shooting, now being remembered for their bravery.
They died heroes, and heroes deserve to live, and they're going to live through us now. We're going to be their heroes and live Jewish strong and proud. And they were Australian, they lived the Australian dream, and they died defending the Australian dream.
I have to say, I think those people are first hero. They are real hero for, not only for Jewish community, they're hero for everyone in the world. And everyone in the world have to know their names.
Dashcam footage captured on Sunday night shows Boris in a purple shirt tackling one of the gunmen to the ground and briefly disarming him before both he and his wife were killed.
Even in the final moments of their lives, they show the depth of who they were, facing those moments with courage, selflessness, and love.
Today, their eulogy was delivered by Rabbi Yehoram Ullman, who was also the father-in-law of another victim of the Bondi attack, Rabbi Eli Schlenger.
The world has seen the footage. They've seen a terrorist taking out his gun and courageously attacked him, tragically to be killed with a second gun. In doing so, they reminded us that they were not only devoted parents and partners, but in every sense of the word, heroes.
Rabbi Ullman also described the couple's journey to Australia.
They left the USSR, the part of the world now called Ukraine, leaving behind familiarity and certainty to begin again. They started from ground zero in Sydney, Australia, in a new country, a new language, and a completely new life. They were often genuinely perplexed when people spoke about traveling overseas, wondering why you'd ever leave when paradise was right at your front door, just down the road at Bondi Beach.
He then read aloud words written by Boris and Sophia's son, Alex.
What made Sophia and Boris such a strong partnership was not just how hard they worked, but how well they understood each other. They shared a sense of humor that still echoes through the Gurman family, and an instinctive understanding of when to push forward and when to steady one another. They were partners in every sense, and together they built a life filled with warmth, effort, and love.
Funerals for two other Bondi victims were held today. One of them was Boris Tetleroid, whose family described him as a gentle man who loved everyone he met. The other was Edith Brutman, who's been remembered as a woman with unique love, loyalty, and devotion. The Prime Minister has announced this Sunday will be a day of reflection to honour the victims of the Bondi Beach terrorist attack. He's asked Australians to observe 1 minute of silence.
We invite people across Australia to light a candle at 6:47 p.m, exactly 1 week since the attack unfolded, as a quiet act of remembrance with family, friends, or loved ones.
In hospital, another Bondi hero, Ahmed Al-Ahmed, is still recovering. He's just received a cheque for more than $2.5 million in donations after a fundraiser to honour his selfless act. He's released a statement which reads, "Stand with each other, all human beings, and keep going to save lives. When I do save the people, I do it from the heart. God protect Australia. Aussie, Aussie, Aussie."
Alison Shaw with that report. Seven Victorian men detained by police in Sydney last night have been released from custody this afternoon. In dramatic scenes, heavily armed tactical officers rammed one of the group's cars after receiving information they may have been travelling to Bondi and planning a violent act. Rachel Hayter has more.
Men with their hands cable-tied behind their backs lie face down on the street in Liverpool in southwest Sydney. Heavily armed police wearing green tactical gear arrested seven men aged between 19 and 24 last night after ramming a white hatchback. This afternoon, New South Wales Police Commissioner Mal Lanyon confirmed the group was travelling from Victoria and all seven men were known to Victoria Police.
The potential of a violent offence being committed was such that we were not prepared to tolerate the risk and interdicted accordingly.
Intelligence sources have confirmed one of the men arrested was under investigation by ASIO.
The information received was that Bondi may have been one of a number of locations that the males were intending to attend, but the reason for attending is unknown.
Commissioner Lanyon says there's no confirmed link between the group and the Bondi gunmen, but they may have similar ideologies.
We're certainly looking at radical Islamist extremism as one of the ideologies behind these males.
He also says police have been meeting regularly with members of the local Islamic community who've unequivocally condemned the Bondi massacre.
They are deeply offended by what we saw on Sunday. It is an abhorrent act. All of the community are hurting.
The seven men were released this afternoon.
We will monitor these men whilst they're in New South Wales and we'll work closely with Victorian and other Commonwealth law enforcement partners.
The Federal Police Commissioner Chrissy Barrett says information about the group who were travelling from Victoria in two cars was passed to New South Wales Police by partner agencies, but she wouldn't say which ones.
It is an example of the high threat environment that we're operating in, and it's an example that the members of the public can be confident that police will take swift and decisive action.
Commissioner Barrett has also given an update on Special Operation Avalite, which was set up to investigate threats, violence and hatred toward Jewish Australians.
The AFP has 161 current Avalite investigations and 10 individuals have already been charged. Now, this is just unbelievable. As a country, we should really reflect on those statistics.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has today announced there'll be more money for Avalite, but it's not clear how much.
We will also boost the AFP and the work they're doing through Operation Avalite. This is the operation that was established, of course, to deal with anti-Semitism. We will provide extra funds to provide the National Security Investigation Teams.
Meanwhile, as the investigation into Sunday's massacre continues, the evidence the shooters were inspired by the ISIS terrorist organisation is growing.
Today, we've been informed that by the Office of National Intelligence has identified a regular online video feed from ISIS that reinforces that this was an ISIS-inspired attack. One proponent of support for ISIS, motivated by a perversion of Islam that leads to extremism, is one too many.
Mr. Albanese says radical Islamist ideology is one of a number of domestic security threats Australia is dealing with right now.
The assessments that that is one of the issues that we're dealing with. But I want to deal with all of the threats, whether it be extremist perversions of Islam leading to support for the ideology promoted by ISIS, whether it be also concerned about the issue of sovereign citizens killing police in Victoria and Queensland. I'm concerned about neo-Nazis thinking it's okay to march down our streets dressed in black, not worrying about their faces being covered.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. Rachel Hayter with that report. And Mr. Albanese has also announced today that the Bondi attack is prompting the government to establish a national gun buyback scheme. It'll be the biggest program of its kind since the one introduced after the 1996 Port Arthur tragedy. Mr. Albanese says owners will be asked to hand in surplus, newly banned and illegal firearms.
There are now more than 4 million firearms in Australia, more than at the time of the Port Arthur massacre, nearly 30 years ago. The government will introduce legislation to support the funding of this buyback scheme and meet the costs on a 50-50 basis with states and territories. We expect hundreds of thousands of firearms will be collected and destroyed through this scheme. Consistent with the approach that was taken in 1996, the government is proposing that states and territories will be responsible for the collection, processing and payment to individuals for surrendered firearms. The Australian Federal Police will then be responsible for the destruction of these firearms.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. Rebecca Peters led the movement that successfully campaigned for gun law reform in the wake of the Port Arthur disaster. She was the chair of the Coalition for Gun Control. She now advises groups around the world. She told me she's pleased another buyback is being introduced in Australia, and she thinks lessons can be learnt from the experience of 1996.
The original buyback was organised very quickly, and of course it's always hard to get things organised, coordinated between the jurisdictions. But for example, one thing that happened was there was some confusion between jurisdictions as to what guns would be paid for. So for example, if somebody was handing in guns that were already prohibited before the Port Arthur laws, like, you know, fully automatic machine guns, some states paid compensation for those and some didn't because it wasn't clear whether they were supposed to or not. I think it was $460,000 paid for a pair of cannon that somebody handed in, which, you know, that wasn't the intention to use $500,000 of the money to pay one person. Anyway, so I think they need to be really clear on what the rules are going to be. So that would be really important to be clear and consistent between the states and also to be clear and consistent on the list of values so that you didn't have forum shopping, you know, people moving guns across the country to try to hand them in a place where they might get more money for them or something like that. And another problem with the buyback was there was a real missed opportunity in terms of data. Like the focus was on counting the number of guns turned in, but they didn't count, for example, the number of people who handed them in. And that would have been really important for us to know in how many people's hands were these guns. And also, they didn't keep track. They didn't identify like the serial numbers of the guns that were destroyed, which would also have been really important because there are probably a lot of guns cluttering up still our data systems, which have been destroyed.
This gun buyback, the Prime Minister says, is for surplus weapons, newly banned weapons and illegal guns. Are they the right categories?
For example, someone who has a bunch of guns legally now, but who under the new rules will not qualify to have them. That, I hope, is what the Prime Minister means when he says surplus or illegal. I mean, you don't want to stigmatize people who own a lot of guns at the moment perfectly legally. You're not saying you have to get rid of these guns because you're a bad person. You're saying you need to hand in these guns because this is now illegal. We know now that the average gun owner in Australia has 4 guns. And, you know, even if you're a farmer, you only really need a maximum of about 3 guns. It's very, very hard to imagine that very many people who are not farmers have a good reason to have more than one gun.
Well, New South Wales has announced today that it's going to legislate to limit the number of guns a person can be licensed to hold to 4. It sounds like you're saying that's still too high.
Well, it's better than having no limit, which is what they have at the moment. But my concern is that the licensing authorities then tend to think, oh, well, as long as it's maximum 4, we don't have to pay any attention. What they should do is bring back the requirement to prove a genuine reason for each gun. In addition, the genuine reason beyond the genuine reason that they proved for their first gun,
Getting back to the newly announced buyback, Rebecca Peters, how likely is it that people with extremist views or criminals with illegal weapons will hand them in?
I think between peer pressure, public education, and just the changing of the culture, not everybody will hand them in, but a lot of people will. Everyone that gets off the streets makes Australia safer.
What was the profile of the people who handed in their weapons at the last gun buyback?
People handed in all kinds of things, a lot of guns, you know, like leftover grandpa's rifle from the war or things like that. Some people found it very, very difficult to hand in their own weapons, and they sent down a member of their household to hand them in. And for many people, it was very important to see that their weapon was destroyed. They did not want to run the risk that the buyback was going to be crooked, that the police were going to steal their gun or use it or sell it or something. And that's another thing, is that I think that there was a lot of effort made to build confidence in the buyback, in terms of, so that the people handing in their guns understood and got fair value for it. But there were a lot of emotional scenes, and one of the good things was that it was, you know, 96 was the year that Australia did very well in the shooting in the Atlanta Olympics, and those Olympic athletes came back and handed in the semi-automatic rifles that they had won as prizes in different competitions, because semi-automatic rifles are not used in Olympic sports, but they won them in prizes. They came down and said, we agree, these guns are not suitable for, in, you know, civilian hands, and handed them in. And we also had various, you know, the Professional Shooters Association, who are like these Crocodile Dundee type guys with big muscles and tattoos and like super, super macho. They also came and handed in guns, even though they were entitled to, the category of people who could still use semi-automatic weapons was professional shooters, who were the people who eradicate, you know, wild boar from the national parks and stuff. So it was very helpful that those serious about their shooting, but not ideologically opposed to the gun laws, showed their support, came down and did it, and that helped give other regular gun owners more confidence. But it's considered to have been the most successful anywhere in the world.
Rebecca Peters, who chaired Australia's Coalition for Gun Control after the 1996 Port Arthur tragedy. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Well, it seems big changes are coming to Formula One motor racing in the new year. The sport's governing body, the FIA, has announced new rules for the cars, including on their size, shape and engines. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
It's lights out and away we go. And who's got the best start out of the front?
On a Formula One racetrack, every aspect of the car is crucial. Aerodynamics, engine, tyres. Tiny changes to design can make a huge difference. Every 3 or 4 years, motorsport governing body, the International Federation of Automobiles, comes up with a new set of rules determining how Formula One cars can be built. The main goal is to make the racing closer. And next year, the changes are big.
This is this huge regulation change for the sport. It's possibly the biggest one in history. It involves both the cars, the chassis, and the power units, which is effectively the engines.
That's Formula One journalist Stuart Bell. When he says chassis, he's talking about the car's backbone.
It is a huge change for the cars. Smaller and lighter, they'll be 30 kilograms lighter. They'll have active aerodynamics, so that means movable front and rear wings. They'll have narrower tyres. On the power units, they'll have a near 50-50 split between the internal combustion engine and the electrical energy, and they'll run on sustainable fuel.
As of next year, these cars will be shorter, narrower and lighter, which will make them much more nimble around corners. And as Stuart Bell says, they'll be genuine hybrids, half petrol, half electric. It was 2014 when electric components were first introduced to Formula One engines. Those changes meant the V8 engines were replaced by 1.6-litre V6s. Since then, those engines have mainly used petrol power, with some boost from electrical output. But with the changes just announced, the engines will be producing half of their power from petrol and half from electric.
So this has been pushed by the FIA, the governing body of World Motorsport. It's in the interest of bringing new manufacturers into the sport, because these engines are endlessly complex. And so traditionally, in the past, it's just been an internal combustion engine, but in the modern age, these are hybrid engines with electrical power associated with them.
Stuart Bell says every time a new set of rules is introduced for Formula One cars, it's a sign of the direction the wider auto industry is heading in.
They're looking for technology transfer in terms of being able to put that technology to their road cars.
And that's no small feat. Each Grand Prix team has more than 1,000 personnel working on car designs. And now, a new budget limit of more than $325 million Australian each year to do so.
It's not a cheap exercise, but collectively, they're developing technology for the future. So that's why, you know, they're investing lots of money.
The first test for the new cars will be the Australian 2026 Grand Prix. And despite a subpar 2025 season, Stuart Bell has his money on Mercedes.
They understood at the start of the hybrid regulations in 2014 how massive these technical challenges are, and they've been at the forefront of engine and power unit development throughout the recent history.
That's Formula One journalist Stuart Bell. That report from Julia Bergen. In far western Queensland, down long dusty roads, sits one of Australia's most remote cattle stations. Life at Adria Downs is good. There's been plenty of rain this year, water holes are full and feed is plentiful. And its staff are challenging the industry stereotype because the station has now reached the milestone of employing an equal number of male and female workers. Jake Carstens prepared this report.
The 21-year-old Sophie Bruce stepped onto Adria Downs a year and a half ago. She had some idea of what it would be like.
I'd seen heaps of things on Instagram and social media, and I really wanted to try it, so came out here and I absolutely love it.
There's a lot of space on the 875,000-hectare organic cattle property on the edge of the Mungatheri-Simpson Desert in Queensland's far west. But it's a tight-knit community for the workers who now call it home.
I met my boyfriend at the pub in town. He worked there.
Yeah, we always eat together. It's like, you know, going having dinner with your family, pretty much. Lots of steak, believe it or not.
Cattle are mustered and trucked out almost every week of the year. And when there's a rare day off, they'll spend it swimming or retreating to the aircon.
If it's too hot, we'll sit in our rooms, watch some shows, and we also play a lot of card games and like board games.
The idea of life out on the edge of the desert has pulled in workers from across the world. And for the first time, there's an even number of female and male ringers.
I really like going mustering. It's really fun. You get dropped off somewhere and you just get told to ride in a direction and find some cattle and you're like, oh yeah, radio.
That's 23-year-old Storm Foxwell, who moved here from New Zealand last year.
It's so hard to describe this place and like how big it is and just what you see in a day. Me coming out here has changed so much for me, so I think the fact that it's a big desert and people still live here, I was intrigued.
UK backpacker Matthew Carter says he was drawn to rural work when he came to Australia 3 years ago.
I think the station work is the essence of Australia. If you want a proper Australian experience, you don't go to a bar in Sydney, you go to the outback somewhere in Australia.
Head stocky Wilson Love says he's worked at Adria Downs for the past 3 years.
There's everything I love here and lifestyle, the country that comes with it and that sort of stuff. And you get to come home and you live places like this right on the waterhole and you just get to hang out with pretty good people every day and you do stuff you want to do. And people normally leave here, I think, a little bit better than when they came. So it makes it a bit more rewarding when you can see them throughout the year get a bit better and that. So
Adria Downs is one of several properties owned by the Brooke family. David Brooke's great-grandfather purchased the pastoral lease in 1939, and the station was originally managed from Birdsville until construction of a homestead in 2005. The station is managed by Don Raymond.
To know that you've played a small part in guiding those kids, both boys and girls, to be better people is what makes me keep going every day.
A game of golf and a canoe race down the river wraps up the year at the work Christmas party. Young workers come and go at Adria Downs, and after 18 months, Sophie Bruce is about to leave the desert behind. But she says she'll carry a small part of this very big property with her.
I've learnt so many things just from doing things in the shed to going out mustering, and a lot of things with how to interact with people too. I will absolutely miss it so much.
Well, before that animal, we were hearing from Adria Downs cattle station worker Sophie Bruce. That was Jay Carstens reporting from Queensland's Far West. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, I'm Andy Park with the ABC News Daily Podcast. Be alert, but not alarmed. If you lived through 9/11, you would have heard that saying on repeat. And by all reports, the terror hotline did work to prevent terror attacks. But what else actually works? The Prime Minister says new laws to tackle anti-Semitism will, including powers to deport so-called hate preachers and a new criminal charge for those advocating racial supremacy. Today, the Lowy Institute's Lydia Khalil on how to stop the next terror attack. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.